Next case is United States v. Kim. Captain Rim, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant? And Captain Hartzell, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson and members of the court, may it please the court. The government stepped into the mind of the appellant and criminalized his fantasies. According to their brief, what mattered most to the government is what was in appellant's head. Appellant's claim for failure to state an offense is not waived for two reasons. First, appellant's claim is not waived under RCM 910 Juliet and Mena. Second, appellant has not affirmatively waived his claim. Even if, additionally, this claim is waived, appellant's plea is improvident because the inquiry fails to meet the Hartman standard. With that, I respectfully welcome the court's questions.
So you cite to Hartman. Now, at the end of your brief, you say that, in fact, the military judge failed to comply with the heightened plea requirements of Hartman. The government responds by saying the military judge went through the law and the facts, and the appellant admitted, at that point the accused, admitted all the elements and so forth. What explicitly do you think the military judge was required to do in addition to what the government cites in order to be in compliance with Hartman?
Your Honor, first, the military judge was not clear in the critical distinction between what is and what is not lawful. So there's no discussion about whether the videos are constitutionally protected. And clearly the inquiry shows that appellant's answers are concerned with focusing on the protected material. So that's missing. There's a lack of discussion about military factors, military environment, military unit. The military judge didn't walk through any discussion on those things. Regarding Your Honor's point about the military judge asking and the appellant answering. So looking to United States v. Jordan, any questions asking appellant to agree to legal conclusions set forth by the military judge, merely eliciting legal conclusions, do not establish an adequate factual predicate for the guilty plea. Conclusions of law alone are insufficient in a plea inquiry.
So if this court were to find that the military judge abused his discretion, failed to conduct the heightened plea inquiry under Hartman, would that determination moot all the other issues in this case?
No, Your Honor. There are separate lines of inquiry independent of each other, while both adequately apply to this scenario because it is a guilty plea. However, appellant's claim for failure to state an offense, which is how the Army Court has characterized it, that is not mooted because they're separate in their analyses.
Counsel, can you explain that a little further? I mean, suppose we were to hold simply that the Providence inquiry was insufficient because of Hartman and set aside the guilty plea on that ground. Would we have to reach any other issues?
Your Honor, this court does not have to because they are independent bases for analysis. If the court decides that it's an improvident plea, that would be a separate distinction from whatever it concludes regarding issue one. With that, does that answer Your Honor's question?
I think so. Can you answer a completely unrelated question, which is, can you explain RCM 910J to me? What does factual issue of guilt mean? What is the definition of that phrase?
Your Honor, so I think the operative phrase in 910 Juliet is, insofar as the objection relates to the factual issue of guilt to the offense. So reworded, we understand, if the objection goes to a factual issue of guilt, it's waived by the guilty plea. If it doesn't go to a factual issue of guilt, it's not waived. And looking to Mena, it, in terms of the language of Mena being not logically inconsistent with the valid establishment of guilt. So The question being, the claim is that the government may not convict appellant no matter how validly his factual guilt is established. If all facts being true doesn't change the analysis that there is no crime to be seen here, appellant's challenge doesn't go to adding or removing any pieces of evidence already discussed in the guilty plea, that claim is not waived.
Thank you.
Counselor, are you challenging the conclusion that the search terms and the materials that were retrieved with the search terms were obscene?
Your Honor, I think the government has addressed it in their brief that the search terms or the searching is not the conduct at issue.
Okay, so then just the materials retrieved as a result of the search, that are you challenging that those were not, that those were obscene, or can we just assume that those materials are obscene?
Your Honor, we would not assume that those were obscene, because the inquiry does not establish validly, as we were discussing in the Hartman concern, that there is nothing in the record that delineates what part meets the obscenity requirements and what does not, other than just bald conclusions put forth by the military judge.
Well, the reason I'm asking is because if those are obscene materials, the only path towards saying that they're protected constitutionally would be to say that Stanley v. Georgia applies, right? And it's your assertion that Stanley does apply.
Correct, Your Honor.
Does it make, now this court has frequently, many courts, I think all courts, have been cautious about extending Stanley beyond its facts. Here, I think both that argument was made in Wilcox, it was made in Meekin, we see it all the time. Here we have someone who is at least sending materials out into the world, right, beyond the confines of their home, and retrieving digital materials from the outside world. Does that take the case beyond the limited facts of Stanley?
No, it does not, Your Honor, given the amount of time which has passed since Stanley was decided, and the Supreme Court discussing the complexities of the digital world and how commonplace it is. A case that comes to mind right now is Reno v. ACLU, even if it's 1997. A lot has happened, and even more regarding the Internet. So this court, in terms of expanding the scope of obscenity to cover search terms, which everyone does every day, all the time, very commonplace, this court should hesitate to extend the bounds of obscenity in classifying it that way. That would be the first concern, Your Honor. Secondly, to your question about Stanley v. Georgia and the zone, in a related point, the record is void of anything that suggests appellant's thoughts to be non-private. So there's no public aspect in the record to appellant's thoughts and how he described his mind, how he described his reminiscences. All of this is private and couldn't be more private. So the record being devoid of any facts that discuss a public aspect, and then to go back to the search terms, it would be very difficult to construe these facts as not meeting that zone of privacy discussed in Stanley. Your Honor, we had discussed the Hartman concern. We had discussed briefly whether the conduct was considered to be indecent. Along the point of indecency, I would like to highlight that we're not sure from the colloquy whether the conduct at issue for the trial court was the searching or the viewing of the videos or the thoughts that came subsequently and the reminiscence there that appellant has said was in his mind. So that would be a concern going to what are we going to say is obscene or not obscene. And some of the search terms on its face is facially not even suggestive. And so that would be a difficulty in terms of the indecency analysis. The appellant responding to government's brief, the conduct that the government discusses in their brief to be at issue is different than what the trial court had discussed with the appellant. So there is a disconnect there that the trial court seemed concerned with in how it handled the search terms, in how it handled the subsequent viewing, and how it handled it. And the colloquy indicates as such. The government now proposed that the conduct at issue is the mind of the appellant. So that is something that I'd like to point out for the court.
Captain Ram, can I ask you a question on the waiver issue? It looks like, correct me if I'm wrong, I know that your position on the waiver issue is that the accused was talking about a different offense than the one at issue here. Is that right? That's your position on the waiver issue? In other words, the government's saying it's an affirmative waiver, and I think you're saying that, well, look, that went to a different offense. It didn't go to this offense of the indecent conduct.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, but let me ask you, it seems like the accused in this case, your client, used this waiver to obtain benefits under the pretrial agreement and, in fact, and indeed did benefit from it. Is that right?
The plea agreement was beneficial, Your Honor.
Right, but on my, you disagree with me on the second, on the first part of it, in that he took advantage of the offer to waive a specific motion to gain the benefits of the plea agreement. You're not agreeing with my statement there, it sounds like.
Your Honor, if I may respond.
Please, please.
So the colloquy shows that the military judge discussed the waiver provision, which is not a waive all waivables. So the waivable, the waived provision and the motions covered in that. So the parties had a deliberate intent to discuss these specific motions, one of them being the failure to state an offense claim, which the inquiry revealed to be pertaining to charge 5. So there's a complete lack of discussion about a failure to state an offense claim and any motions regarding that for charge 6. So if we're looking at this through the lens of affirmative waiver, whether there was an intentional relinquishment of a known right, the colloquy indicates that the parties did not intend, at least deliberately, to discuss charge 6 and the failure to state an offense claim there. Regarding whether or not the plea agreement was beneficial, Your Honor, I think we go back to the consideration of 910 Juliet and Mena, and actually what a difficult hurdle that is, that if in that narrow scope an appellant's claim meets non-waiver, and this court is looking at it for plain error, as this court has previously discussed, it is a difficult hurdle for appellants to surmount. The facts all being true here, however, in appellant's case, there is still a lack of a crime. So in the sense that there might have been some benefit to the other known and discussed provisions covered by the plea agreement, this failure to state an offense claim for charge 6 does not fall within that scope.
Thank you.
Pending any further questions?
Seeing none, we'll move on. Thank you, Captain Rim. Captain Hartzell?
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. Good morning. My name is Captain Josh Hartzell, and I, along with my co-counsel, Major Pamela Jones, represent the United States. This court should affirm the conviction for three reasons. The first reason is that the failure to state an offense objection was waived when the appellant pled guilty unconditionally at trial. The second is that there was actually indecent conduct in this case. And lastly, the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he accepted this guilty plea and complied with the heightened standards under U.S. v. Hartman.
Now, in terms of the last point, it's your position that this was not just what happened with this particular charge six. It was not just a routine style colloquy that somehow it meets the level of the heightened requirements under Hartman. How so? What did the military judge do here that would have not have occurred in a typical case where constitutional issues were not implicated?
Your Honor, the military judge here complied with Hartman by taking the magic language, which there is none, and put it into plain language. He engaged in a discussion with the appellant in plain language that the appellant understood and gave affirmative answers to. And under Hartman, the judge is required to go through this conversation about when there's appropriate conduct, or permissible versus prohibited conduct. And we would maintain in this case the judge did that by positing a dichotomy together during the colloquy. Specifically, I'm looking at page JA 80 through 84, as well as that dichotomy is on JA 85, starting on line 13. What the judge does is temporarily sandwich two scenarios. And he says, in plain language, you didn't just look for these search terms, drugs, sleep, rape, sleep. You didn't look for these just to satisfy a curiosity. They exist. The appellant says no. The military judge follows that up with, you looked for this because it reminded you of the time that you sexually abused. And the appellant says yes. This temporal sandwiching of these two scenarios and the appellant's clear understanding that the first one, no, I didn't do it for that reason. It's a perfectly fine reason. I did it for the second reason, the prohibited reason. We think by moving that out of the terms of art, constitutional, unconstitutional, which the judge actually moved those down into the plain language that the appellant could understand and knowingly.
So you're saying it was a benefit to the accused that the military judge never said anything about constitutionally protected, First Amendment, anything like that?
Your Honor, we would say that the judge complied with the spirit of Hartman in that he put the language in something that he could feel confident that the appellant understood.
So you're focusing on this issue of military judge saying, you didn't just do that, you also were having these evil thoughts. How was the thinking of the accused relevant under the charge defense? Charge defense doesn't say anything about the thinking, the thoughts of the accused. Simply says you look for these search terms that could be, in fact, legal pornography.
Yes, Your Honor. So the government takes the position that context in this case matters. And it's the thinking plus the fact he has already sexually abused in a very similar manner, in that she was on medication, which made her hallucinate. He would abuse her. He would keep her up late at night, and then he would abuse her right as she was in that twilight period between awake and asleep, very similar to the things that he was searching for. And so we would say putting that all together, but critically here, there's the service discrediting piece. And that's what pushes this, we think, into criminal conduct that's cognizable under the UCMJ. So we have that service discrediting piece mentioned multiple times in the stipulation of fact as well as in the record. So he brings it up often in between JA 80 through 84 that he understands this conduct is reprehensible. He understands that it's – the judge actually goes through in the terms of art with the defendant, with the accused, or I'm sorry, with the appellant in this case, in that he goes through and explains what indecent means. And then he goes through in plain language, as well as the term of art, explains what service discrediting means. Then in plain language, the appellant goes through and talks about how he knows that this is bad stuff. He knows that this is wrong. He knows what he is doing. Critically, if it were to be found out by members of the public, would lower the esteem of the military and the army.
I mean, you're arguing that the military judge did a textbook job of running a plea colloquy, which I agree with. I mean, but for the Hartman problem, you couldn't ask for a better plea colloquy, right? He nailed down, despite the vagueness of Article 134 and all of the issues with that, he nailed down every part of it. Except, we're struggling with where does he meet the heightened Hartman standard, which requires the military judge to draw what it calls the critical distinction between constitutionally protected behavior, despite the fact that it's service discrediting, despite the fact that it's indecent, despite the fact that it's reprehensible, and non-protected behavior. Like where, you pointed us to page 85 in the JA, right? But where is that critical distinction being drawn for the benefit of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor. So we believe in that relevant passage that we cited earlier that the judge moved the language. He still drew the critical distinction. He just did it in a way that perhaps the appellant could completely understand. And so all that's required under Hartman is this appropriate discussion, and the government argues that the appropriate discussion was conducted because he drew the distinction in terms that the appellant could understand.
Does the government concede that the appellant's constitutional rights under Stanley were at least implicated in this case?
Yes, sir.
So Stanley definitely applies.
Stanley applies.
Or is at least implicated. We won't conclude that it applies, but we'll say that it's implicated.
Yes, Your Honor, and that there is a First Amendment issue at play here. However, there is the service discrediting component as well as the contextual matters that I talked about earlier that we feel really give this case some distinction between Stanley, and we think that, again, that the Hartman standards were satisfied.
Is that the only – so that's really the only path – on that question, that's the only path to victory for the government on that QP is that we would agree that the heightened Hartman standard was satisfied.
Yes, Your Honor. The government thinks that the – believes that the judge fully satisfied that requirement, and we believe that by engaging in that appropriate level of discussion – on a level that the appellant could understand, satisfies the character and the nature, the spirit of Hartman.
So is your argument is that had the military judge mentioned anything about the Constitution and the First Amendment, and that would have been beyond the understanding of the accused as he sat next to his learned counsel?
The government would not characterize it that way, Judge, or Your Honor. What I believe the argument we would wish to make is that the judge took extra care because he wanted to make sure that the appellant understood what he was giving up.
Right, but I guess I don't understand. I mean, you don't have to be a seasoned lawyer to understand what the word constitutional means. I mean, he could have explained that if he was that concerned about the accused understanding, couldn't he have just mentioned those words and explained it and said, you're sitting next to your counsel, why don't you take a minute to ask him about what I have just described to you as far as the constitutional distinctions in this case? Couldn't he have said that?
Yes, Your Honor, it's possible he could have said any number of things that potentially would satisfy a little bit more for what the?
Well, I guess I'm challenging your approach or your argument that he was concerned about the ability of the accused to understand. And I guess I'm positing why that would be if we're really not talking about, you know, highly complex concepts. And he's got a lawyer sitting next to him.
Yes, Your Honor. So if you look through the full record of this, especially during the portion, it's contained mostly within this, the relevant passages within the JA are 80 through 84 for the entirety of this charge. But there are multiple times where the judge talks to the appellant and says, just tell me what you mean. Tell me what you mean in your language. He is searching for communication, searching for perfect understanding with the appellant. And so I wasn't there, we have to take the record that the judge could tell if his points were being picked up or not and was moving for perfect understanding in this case.
So how would you have this court write that opinion? We say, well, we think the military judge understood what was going on here. That's how we would write the opinion here, saying there's this heightened standard that involves the Constitution. He dumbed it down really to such a degree that the accused could understand it. We can't, as members of this court, see how there was an explanation about, hey, this could be legally protected conduct or this could be criminal conduct. How would you have us write the opinion here to say this passes muster?
Your Honor, we would be very comfortable having an opinion written that says that this judge did delineate that distinction between prohibited and permissible conduct. Because
by invoking the fact that he was thinking about
in the context of a service discrediting prohibited behavior. Yes, Your Honor. So the critical distinction.
Here's the issue. When you're not saying, I think in response to a question, you were saying that the government acknowledges that this could be constitutional behavior, protected.
Yes, Your Honor.
Behavior. So that if any service member were to Google drug to sleep, that would not necessarily constitute an offense under the code.
In and of itself, Your Honor, no.
But then it seems to be the leap you're making is, well, the military judge then said, well, you were thinking of these things at that time. So are you saying that in other instances, if a service member is Googling drug to sleep and is thinking evil thoughts, that somehow there's A violation of the code, and B, that it would pass constitutional muster?
No, Your Honor. What we are saying is that, taken in context, and under U.S. v. Wilcox, context matters. The reprehensible acts that have already been committed by the appellant in a very similar fashion under what he's searching for, plus the service discrediting aspect of, should that be known, all of those things in toto, that would be cognizable under UCMJ 134. And so the thoughts alone, by in and of themselves, the government would agree, are not criminal behavior.
Counsel, going to your first argument, can you explain to me what RCM 910J means when it uses the phrase factual issue of guilt?
Your Honor, we would posit that the factual issues of guilt, especially in an unconditional guilty plea, would go to the elements of the offense being satisfied, and that the judge is, especially under U.S. v. Hartman, satisfied with the providency of the appellant and his ability to enter into that guilty plea. And if that happens, all non-jurisdictional issues are waived.
As a follow-on to Judge Maggs' question, would you agree that there's a distinction between a motion to a purely legal motion and an issue that involves whether or not I was there or not? For instance, had my appeal, I just discovered that, hey, wait a minute, that may not have been me. Kind of ridiculous, but, I mean, the distinction I guess I'm trying to draw is that the first issue, in other words, a purely legal issue, something like the sufficiency of the specification, so to speak, or some other legal issue, some search issue, some issue dealing with the accused having rendered a statement to the authorities. Isn't that all different from a purely factual issue that goes to something, although ridiculous, but makes my point, that I'm not the one who committed the crime. That's not me, in retrospect.
For the purposes of a failure to state an offense, which is at issue here, Your Honor, we would argue that the failure to state an offense was waived. In terms of your entire encompassing question, I think it would be dependent upon the facts of the case.
Okay, the failure to state an offense, does it sound more like the first box I used where you have this issue of this legal issue, or does it sound more like the second box, the second instance?
The government would agree with the Army Court of Criminal Appeals that it is more like the first, Your Honor.
I see. Okay. Thank you. I can't get anybody to agree with me today.
For the issue of the waiver, to your point about affirmative versus waive all waivables, the judge does go through in a colloquy with the appellant on page JA 90 and 91, where he uses the words motions. It's not talking specifically. They go through with the appellant's attorneys about the specific motion, and then the judge at the end of that says to the appellant, you understand that this will then waive all motions, you're waiving motions, plural. And so we do feel, though, Your Honor, that this goes to that waived issue, and the unconditional guilty plea takes care of that. Pending any further questions from the court.
Thank you, Captain Hartzell. Captain Rim.
Your Honor, I'll begin citing to a quote from Stanley that admonishes against certain intrusions that the government might attempt in encroaching upon our liberties under the First Amendment. The Stanley Court urged that the door barring government intrusion into First Amendment protections cannot be left ajar. The door must be kept tightly closed and open only the slightest crack necessary to prevent encroachment upon more important interests. No such important interests exist here for the government. The government would look to the perceived need for investigating or considering or policing context as they had considered appellant's other offenses. The government wants to fling open the door that Stanley warned against, remove constitutional protections, which they admit are existent here, and usher in an Orwellian door, an Orwellian world, Orwellian restrictions. This court should not review Stanley to be so distinguishable as the government would state, that the police power of the government simply does not extend to private thoughts. In going back to specifically the context in Wilcox that the government has mentioned, earlier we discussed Hartman and the lack of military factors discussed in the appellant's plea inquiry. Wilcox is even more specific. that there has to be a reasonably direct and palpable connection to a military mission or military environment. That discussion is completely devoid here. There hasn't been any information given by the military judge to the appellant about what we're talking about when it comes to the military environment beyond merely his status as a service member. According to the government's definition of why this context matters, and applying the definition that the government proposed, first, looking to JA-85 and the colloquy, appellant's understanding of the order, the micro-order of what happened in the searching and the viewing and the reminiscing, differ from government. So looking to the colloquy, these videos, these search terms, and the videos that you found from them reminded you of the time you were with your stepdaughter. So we're looking at first searching, then temporary.
I see your time has expired, but I'd like you to finish that one thought.
Yes, Your Honor. The search terms and the videos you found. So first, there was the search. Second, there was the viewing. And then the reminiscing happened. Unlike how the government characterized that the reminiscing might have occurred contemporaneously or earlier in time than the viewing.
Any questions from the bench? Seeing none, Captain Rim, thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
All rise. Court is adjourned until further order of the court.